From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Nigeria's internally displaced, totaling hundreds of thousands. Lawyers discussing the illicit flow of money from Africa. U.S.-Iran talks underway about Tehran's nuclear agenda, plus a club that promotes science and meaning of community. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Nigeria's military says troops have stopped raids on several northeastern villages where Islamic militants from Boko Haram are active. Military says soldiers averted attempted raids on villages in the states of Borno and Adamawa, killing more than 50 militants. There was no independent confirmation of their claims. Meantime, the U.S. State Department spokesperson Marie Harf was asked at Monday's press briefing about the ongoing search for the 200-plus schoolgirls kidnapped by Boko Haram in April.
As we've said in here, there's indications they may have been broken up into small groups, may have been taken to other countries. The search continues. The Nigerians are still in the lead. And tragically, no update yet.
How confident are you that you might be able to track them down?
We're certainly hopeful that we will, and we're committed to putting resources to doing that.
And how long have you, any timeline on how long the U.S. involvement will remain in place?
I don't, but I think, suffice to say, we're going to be there until we find these girls. I don't have any more timeline for you.
Local residents told Wall Street Journal reporters that Nigeria's Islamist insurgency on Monday had kidnapped at least 20 girls more. They say it happened just a few kilometers from the town of Chibok in Borno State, where Boko Haram abducted the schoolgirls on April 15th. New report shows that Nigeria now has the largest internally displaced population in Africa and the third largest in the world. In recent years, hundreds of thousands of people fled Boko Haram insurgents in the northeast, but some families are returning to their homes saying there is nowhere safe for them to hide. We get more now from Heather Murdoch in Abuja.
Last month, reports circulated that residents of Kalabalji, a farming community in northeastern Nigeria, had killed 200 Boko Haram insurgents. About 10 days ago, militants came back for revenge. They stormed 10 villages in the area, burning homes, killing at least 4 people and sending thousands of people running for their lives, says Abba Abdulmumini, a Kalabalji community leader.
The situation is quite pathetic, and it's like the Nigerian government is not willing to act. That is our basic concern. People are being killed like chickens.
He says with no security forces in the area, people wanted to keep fighting, but they ran out of ammunition.
The fighting power of the Boko Haram insurgents cannot be matched by the local weapons around. So, in fact, they have the heart to fight, but they don't have the weapons. They don't have the arms.
Those who fled found no help in a makeshift camp by the Cameroon border. Emergency officials said the area was too dangerous for aid workers to access. Some Kalabalji residents are now returning with their livestock, saying there was not enough grazing land on the other side of the border. On top of that, the militants appear to be able to attack any place at any time of their choosing. Last week, about 350 people were killed in attacks on villages in Borno State, the heart of the insurgency and one of 3 Nigerian states that has been under emergency rule for more than a year. A report released last week by the Norwegian Refugee Council and the Internal Displacement Monitoring Center says there are about 3.3 million displaced people in Nigeria, making it the third largest displaced population in the world, after Syria and Colombia. Emmanuel Ogebe is a Nigeria expert with the Jubilee Campaign, a Christian human rights organization. He says the government has done little to help the displaced.
The atrocities are continuing to worsen, and the government of Nigeria needs to have a strategic human impact mitigation plan, which we don't see.
Khalifa Dikwa, a political analyst and former lecturer at the University of Maiduguri, says for civilians fleeing their homes, the danger is often not just from the insurgents. He says many people run because they are caught in the crossfire.
Both the security agents and the Boko Haram killed them. They are not protected.
Abdulmumini says villagers who returned to Kalabalji said Boko Haram tried to take over the community after the attacks, offering to act as a de facto government. They also went house to house, confiscating weapons. Villagers said they did not want to publicly discuss Boko Haram, even anonymously, for security reasons. In the past 5 years, the radical group has killed thousands of people and kidnapped hundreds of others, including more than 200 schoolgirls that have been held captive for nearly 2 months. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
African lawyers say they are committed to bringing back money illegally taken out of the continent. During a meeting in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé, former South African President Thabo Mbeki said the hemorrhage of money from Africa makes the continent heavily indebted and highly underdeveloped. Moki Edwin Kinzika is in Yaoundé with our report.
The lawyers say illicit financial flows amounting to an estimated $50 billion to $60 billion per year are carried out through theft and bribery by public officials, corporate transactions, criminal activities, international trade, public procurement and contracting, poorly enforced financial regulations, and multinational financial networks. The African lawyers also say much of the loss cannot be traced. The president of the Pan-African Lawyers Union, Elijah Banda, told VOA that illegal outflows are no longer only carried out by corrupt African leaders.
The way we understand financial flows is not people cutting boxes of cash across the borders, but it is being undertaken in a very serious way in multinational transactions, transfer pricing between corporations and their sister corporations overseas. Copper-based countries that have an extractive industry are very prone to these activities. In Zambia, we know that money is leaving the country, which should not, in form of proper declaration of taxes, in form of proper declaration of profits by these multinationals. All those now become illicit flows.
A Nigerian human rights lawyer, Femi Falana, who has been instrumental in trying to bring back money taken out of his country, told VOA that multinational companies work in collaboration with his country's political elite to loot the people's wealth.
The Nigerian government, out of sheer irresponsibility, after 54 years, does not know how much oil is produced in Nigeria daily. We simply rely on what Shell, Mobil, and the rest of them tell us. This is what we have lifted from the ground. We lose not less than sometimes, in 2011, $16 billion in 1 year.
Falana says bad legislation also facilitates the illegal outflow of money.
In 2011, the National Assembly amended the Money Laundering Act to allow anybody traveling out of the country to go out with any amount once you declare it. That is primitive. What used to happen before then was that nobody could go out of the country with more than $10,000 cash. Any other amount beyond that has to go through a banking process. But when you say I can just make millions of dollars, get to the airport, declare it, and take it out, for me, it's primitive.
A joint report by the African Development Bank and the United States advocacy group Global Financial Integrity presented during the conference indicated that between $1.2 trillion and $1.4 trillion left Africa in illicit financial flows between 1980 and 2009, an amount which is almost equal to Africa's current gross domestic profit. Cameroonian-born lawyer Akere Mona told VOA they are working with the World Bank to trace the money.
The World Bank calls its initiative about money that has been taken out the Stolen Assets Recovery Initiative. So the World Bank is calling the money that has been taken out stolen assets. It means, therefore, that if any bank deals with that money, it is dealing with stolen assets.
It will not be an easy thing to trace and bring back the money. Anna Gardner of the London-based non-governmental organization International Lawyers for Africa told VOA that the process is often long and cumbersome.
Firstly, there has to be due diligence in the victim country to identify how much money is missing. Then there is a process of, once that's identified, to get court orders to say that those assets have now been identified, they need to be frozen, and then the real process then starts. It's a long and convoluted process. The burden of proof is too great.
Barrister Elijah Banda, however, says the lawyers resolved to bring the matter to the attention of the wider African public and the world through targeted messaging and the building of strong coalitions and partnerships. As Thabo Mbeki says, the massive illicit loss of money continues to hurt Africa's financial condition, development, and its future. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
South Africa's government has pulled out of mediation efforts between major platinum producers and striking workers, saying the talks are deadlocked. About 70,000 workers at three of South Africa's largest platinum mines have been on strike for 5 months, demanding higher wages. South Africa's government stepped in last month to try to break up the deadlock following several rounds of failed negotiations between the companies and the mine workers.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has strongly condemned Sunday's deadly terrorist attack in Pakistan, saying it is deeply concerned by the upsurge in violence across the country. Mr. Ban's comments in a statement Monday came hours after Pakistan Taliban militants claimed responsibility for the siege at Karachi's Jinnah International Airport that killed at least 28 people, including 10 gunmen. Pakistan's Interior Minister Chaudhry Nisar Ali Khan has warned that the whole country needs to be on alert following Sunday's attack.
So ek uneven ladai hai. Pakistan is waqt pura conflict zone bana hua hai.
Khan said, it's an uneven fight. Pakistan is now a conflict zone. To keep this in mind, he says, there are threats everywhere. Our intelligence agencies, media, and people have to be proactive. He says, every area is a target. Every building is a potential target. Two bombs targeting Kurdish political party offices in northern Iraq have killed at least 30 people. Car bomb blew up at a checkpoint near the offices of President Jalal Talabani's Patriotic Union of Kurdistan. Short time later, a truck packed with explosives was detonated, tacked the second in as many days against the party offices. An al-Qaeda splinter group known as the Islamic State of Iraq in the Levant claimed responsibility for the attack on Sunday near Baghdad. A senior Iranian official says nuclear talks with the West may have to be extended another 6 months if no deal is reached by the July 20th deadline. Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Adranji is quoted by Iran's official news agency after the first day of direct talks with the United States in Geneva. The two-day meeting is aimed at preparing both sides for next week's international negotiations in Vienna. U.S. State Department spokesperson Marie Harf was asked by reporters Monday about the status of the talks with Iran.
We are at a critical juncture in the talks. We don't have very much time left. We think we've made progress during some rounds, but as we said coming out of the last one, we hadn't seen enough made. We hadn't seen enough realism, quite frankly, on the table. And hopefully these discussions, like the other bilateral discussions people have, can help get us to the place we want to be.
Iran agreed last November to curb its uranium enrichment program in exchange for the easing of Western sanctions, also for the talks toward a comprehensive deal. United States and its allies suspect Iran of trying to build a nuclear bomb. Iran insists it is not doing that. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani met with Turkish officials on Monday, including Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan, in the first official Iranian presidential visit to Turkey since 1996. Iran is both an important trading partner for Turkey and a rival for influence in the region. Turkey anticipating that the upcoming nuclear talks between Iran and the West leads to a further easing of sanctions on Iran is looking to boost energy cooperation.
12 yılın sonunda küsuratları söylemiyorum, 22 milyar dolara ulaştı.
Prime Minister Erdogan said at the end of 2012, trade had reached $22 billion U.S. dollars. He had determined a goal during his trip to Iran in January to reach a trade volume of $30 billion. By the end of 2015, that has fallen short, he says. We're making an effort to get it back on track.
در زمینه مسائل هسته‌ای نظرات ما کاملا مشترک هست.
In his remarks, President Rouhani praised Turkey's position regarding Iran's nuclear standoff with the West and said Turkey has always been cooperative regarding this issue. Mr. Rouhani is expected to sign agreements with Turkey aimed at improving ties that have been strained over the war in Syria, where Iran backs the government and Turkey supports the rebels. In other news, Ukraine's foreign ministry says it's reached a mutual understanding with Russia on key stages of a peace plan for eastern Ukraine. A ministry statement on Monday offered no details after a second day of negotiations in Kiev, those talks mediated by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. But the statement said the contact group had agreed to continue talks aimed at ending fighting in the Luhansk and Donetsk regions of eastern Ukraine. And Ukraine and Russia, along with representatives of the European Union, met in Brussels on Monday to resolve a natural gas dispute. VOA's Gabe Joslow has details.
The heart of the issue is a dispute between the two countries over how much Ukraine should pay for Russian gas. Moscow has threatened to cut off supplies as early as Tuesday if Ukraine does not pay off its debts, a move that would also disrupt flows to Europe. In April, Russia nearly doubled the price of gas to Ukraine to $480 per 1,000 cubic meters, a decision that followed the ousting of Ukraine's former Russian-backed president Viktor Yanukovych. Russia also angered Ukraine with the annexation of Crimea in March, while Russian fighters have been seen among rebels involved in a separatist uprising in eastern Ukraine. Moscow denies the allegations. Valentin Zemlyansky, a former press secretary for Ukraine's gas company Naftogaz, says despite these conflicts between the two countries, he expects both sides to remain pragmatic during gas negotiations. The current situation inside the country, he says, has more of an impact on the mood of society than on relations in the sphere of gas talks. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko, who took office Saturday, has urged a ceasefire this week in the rest of Donbass region, the heart of the pro-Russian insurgency. In his inaugural address, he promised amnesty for fighters who do not have Ukrainian blood on their hands. Meantime, separatist forces accuse Ukraine's military of killing civilians during counterinsurgency operations. In Donetsk province Sunday, a separatist commander held a news conference alongside six captured Ukrainian soldiers. In a video of the event, Commander Sergei Zrilok says he believes the conflict will come to a turning point when Ukrainian soldiers start to realize that they are killing their own people. Zrilok asks the captured soldiers to answer questions about their orders and about whether they feel deceived. They are then asked questions by Russian-speaking journalists. A spokesman for Ukraine's so-called anti-terror operation, Vladislav Selesnyov, denounced the news conference as a farce. In a post on Facebook, he called for the soldiers and prisoners of war to be treated in accordance with international law. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Kyiv.
Subway workers in the Brazilian city of Sao Paulo voted late Monday to suspend their labor strike, which threatened transportation in the country's biggest city just days before it hosts the upcoming World Cup football match. Earlier on Monday, about 150 strikers and their supporters set fire to piles of garbage on one central avenue, and police fired stun grenades and tear gas to disperse them. Subway workers' dispute was the latest in a string of anti-government protests against government spending to host soccer's biggest event and the 2016 Summer Olympics.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
and civilians. Sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians. This
with all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
George Boyce and his wife, Eva Fallon, have finally made their lifelong dream a reality. Last year, the couple founded Green Stems. That's a nonprofit that promotes science and creativity. They turned an empty store in downtown Greenbelt, Maryland, not far from Washington, into a community clubhouse. As VOA's Faith Labatus tells us, it's a space for people, especially kids, to work together or individually on science projects and hobbies.
From the outside, Club 125, named for its street address, looks like any other store in a shopping area. From inside, it is a science lab with dozens of computers, laptops, wires, light bulbs, screws, and more.
Our three core areas are robotics, microelectronics, and computer science.
George Boyce and his wife, Eva Fallon, who both work in internet technology, founded the club.
It gives us an opportunity to introduce kids and their families and adults to science and technology. It gives people an opportunity to work hands-on and learn some new stuff that they might not be able to learn in school, or as adults they don't have an opportunity to work with because they don't have the right resources.
School children come here with their teachers or parents.
I like science, but I like making robots better.
11-year-old Dinah Cohen is a homeschool student. With her father's help, she used the resources at Club 125 to make a robot in the shape of an elephant.
We wanted to make it move. I'd like to make the elephant work better.
Her mother and teacher, Leah Cohen, says visiting Club 125 is a great learning opportunity.
She comes here and has to solve a problem with her Lego robotics. Coming here is really great because it's a really diverse group of people. So Dinah learns from kids who are younger than herself, and she learns how to work with kids that are older than herself. And she also works with the wide variety of adults that are in here too.
That's exactly what George Boyce dreamed the creative space would provide.
We're actually open more hours and different hours from the library, so we're able to provide access to resources like our computer network and our laptop so that the kids can come in.
Boyce and Fallon transformed a dry cleaning store into the community club.
It's very hands-on, and it's also very self-directed.
Fallon says the club is a work in progress.
If someone's interested in something, we try and help them figure out how to learn about it and how to do something with it. Yes, there's some level of direction, but we really try and encourage them to puzzle it out on their own and then show us what they did.
And it's not only about science and technology.
We include some arts and crafts, predominantly because I'm a knitter. We have a popular event, Repair Cafe. Don't throw it away, repair it. So people bring in broken items and volunteers repair them. Or if they're not repairable, we take them to electronics recycling. But we do jewelry repair, we had bicycle repair, small appliances, some furniture repairs.
Volunteers like Wendy Cooler help run the club.
The space serves as something of a community living room. It's like an extension of my home. You know, it continues to challenge us to have better and more meaningful relationships with each other, to share skills and share food and share our lives with each other and help to raise each other's children.
Club 125, she says, defines what a community is and in the process promotes experimentation and curiosity. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Associated Press reporting that the owner of the U.S. professional basketball team, Los Angeles Clippers, has pulled his support from a deal to sell the team to former Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer for $2 billion. AP says Donald Sterling's lawyers say he will also be pursuing a $1 billion federal lawsuit against the National Basketball Association. The sale of the Clippers had been negotiated by his wife, Shelley Sterling, after Sterling's racist remarks to a girlfriend were publicized. And the NBA moved to oust him as owner, also banning from the sport after fining him $2.5 million. Sterling's lawsuit against the NBA alleges the league's violated his constitutional rights by relying on information from an illegal recording that contained the racist remarks. The suit also alleges the league committed to breach of contract by fining Sterling and that it violated antitrust laws by trying to force a sale of his NBA team. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. You know, you can always find us on the Internet as well at voanews.com. And we hope that you'll stay with us. The latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jesse Brooks, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Tuesday.
This is Today in History. On this day in 1752, Benjamin Franklin flew a kite during a thunderstorm and proved the electrical nature of lightning. On June 10, 1793, with the French Revolution waning under the direction of moderates, the more radical Jacobins, a group of strict egalitarians who wanted to do away with class distinctions, seized control of the executive body of the revolution known as the Committee of Public Safety. Using virtually dictatorial powers, the committee was responsible for thousands of executions, most of them by guillotine, during a two-year period we now know as the Reign of Terror. In 1865, Wagner's opera Tristan and Isolde opened in Munich. On this day in 1935, in New York City, two recovering alcoholics, one a stockbroker and the other an Ohio physician, founded Alcoholics Anonymous, a 12-step rehabilitation program that eventually would help countless people deal with alcoholism. On this day in 1980, the African National Congress made public a statement by Nelson Mandela, still in prison, for people to unite, mobilize, fight on against racial apartheid. On this day in 1991, personnel at Clark Air Base in the Philippines were evacuated in anticipation of the eruption of Mount Pinatubo. And on this day in 2004, American musician and entertainer Ray Charles died at the age of 73.
Oh, beautiful, far heroes proved.
Ray Charles helped shape the sound of rhythm and blues.
Liberating strife.
Well, that's it for today. I'm Dave DeForest with Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Founded in 2000 by the United States and Poland, the Community of Democracies is a group of countries dedicated to supporting nations that are in the midst of democratic transitions. Over the years, the organization has expanded, both in terms of its membership and its outreach to every region of the globe. The community has worked to build task forces staffed with experts to help transitioning democracies with tasks such as constitution writing. The LEND Network, which stands for Leaders Engaged in New Democracies Network, is such a resource. LEND was started by reaching out to about 25 countries that had come through successful democratic transitions and identifying key leaders within these societies. These individuals included a former Chief Justice of South Africa's Supreme Court, who wrote that country's constitution, and the former head of the Chilean army, who led the transition to civilian rule. About 35 former presidents and prime ministers joined this effort through a group known as the Club de Madrid. LEND then teamed up with Google and OpenText and other technology partners to build a platform that allows for real-time voice, video, and text communication with translation between leaders who had been through successful transitions in the past and key leaders in countries that were in the midst of transitions today. This made it possible for leaders in Tunisia who were rewriting their constitution to be able to share their draft with experts all over the world who had experience in the topic under discussion. Immediate translation was available, which allowed for feedback in real time about what had and hadn't worked in the course of prior democratic transitions. In effect, the Tunisians had access to world-class information and were able to develop a first-rate constitution. Looking ahead, the Community of Democracies has already taken an active role in responding to the crisis in Ukraine by sending two assessment missions and is preparing further plans to support the development of strong institutions and the rule of law in Ukraine. The United States is strongly committed to helping democratic transitions around the globe succeed. The Community of Democracies remains an important part of that effort.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.